I next met with Dr. Karen Recamp, and to begin, I asked her about a recent editorial she authored in Lancet Oncology about a key issue in systemic management of non-small cell, the use of maintenance treatment.
The issue of maintenance in lung cancer really has exploded over the past few years, and I think in some ways have left us a little more confused than clarified. So probably the first study that brought the issue of maintenance to us was the JMEN trial, which was carboplatin plus Y, non-pemetrexed-containing platinum-based doublet, for four cycles, and those who did not progress then went on to receive either pemetrexed as maintenance therapy or placebo, so no maintenance therapy. And in that study, there was an improvement in progression-free survival, which as part of the editorial, progression-free survival you would expect with an active agent in lung cancer. So really the important thing is overall survival. And there was an overall survival benefit also in this group for the patients who received pemetrexed maintenance. The caveat to this study was that less than 20% of patients actually went on to receive pemetrexed following progression if they didn't receive it as maintenance. So it wasn't as if all those patients received it later on. So the question of whether you could rescue these patients wasn't answered by that study, but does show that there is a potential role for maintenance in that setting. Then moving on to the Paramount study, which was platinum-based doublet with pemetrexed for four cycles, followed by pemetrexed maintenance versus not pemetrexed maintenance. And here you're thinking this is what we consider continuation maintenance versus a switch maintenance. So in this case, we also saw an improvement in progression-free survival and then recently published the improvement in overall survival for patients who receive pemetrexed maintenance following platinum-based doublet with pemetrexed. So this clearly shows that there is a role for pemetrexed maintenance in lung cancer, either as switch maintenance or as continuation maintenance. For another cohort of patients, there is erlotinib maintenance, and that was the Saturn trial. And that was similar to the JMEN, where they received a platinum-based doublet for four cycles, and then the patients who did not progress went on to receive erlotinib versus placebo. In this study, there was a small but statistically significant improvement in progression-free survival and overall survival. And this was across all subgroups, but clearly the subgroup that benefited most with a hazard ratio of 0.1 were the patients who had EGFR mutations in this group. So there is some potential role for erlotinib, especially if patients can't otherwise receive chemotherapy. But it is really a conversation that physicians need to have with their patients, because across the board, chemotherapy, even chemotherapy with limited toxicity, does have toxicity. And so patients have more side effects, whether it's cytopenias or fatigue from chemotherapy-based or rash and diarrhea from erlotinib. And some patients benefit from a break from therapy. And so it's really about quality of life, goals of care, and a careful conversation with the patient and the physician.
I think kind of a related data set that there's been a lot of discussion about has been the so-called Point Break trial. Can you talk a little bit about the design of that study, the outcome, and what you think it means?
So there have been several trials recently presented, Point Break being one of them, that try to kind of clarify where we use maintenance and how we add bevacizumab to that maintenance. So bevacizumab has been used as a continuation maintenance followed by platinum-based doublet with bevacizumab. So Point Break is a continuation of that, where patients received either carboplatin, paclitaxel, plus bevacizumab, followed by bevacizumab maintenance, so really the ECOG 4599 data, versus carboplatin, pemetrexed, bevacizumab, based on Jyoti Patel's data, followed by pemetrexed, bevacizumab maintenance. And that was presented late last year for the first time and basically showed overall survival, no difference between the two arms. And there was potentially, for those patients who went on to receive maintenance, there may have been a slight benefit to receiving pemetrexed bevacizumab maintenance, but this was an unplanned retrospective analysis that they did.
Any comment on other studies that are further attempting to define the optimal regimen? The ECOG has a study, 5508. There's a so-called NEXT study. What are some of the questions that are being looked at in terms of maintenance right now?
So as far as the ECOG 5508 study, that study is now looking at platinum-based doublet as far as switch maintenance with then pemetrexed as maintenance, bevacizumab as maintenance, or bevacizumab and pemetrexed as maintenance. So that will truly help us to understand the combination therapy. It won't help us as much with continuation maintenance as far as the pemetrexed and bevacizumab answer.
In general, what's your usual sort of approach in terms of maintenance in the average patient, bevacizumab eligible, presenting with metastatic adenocarcinoma?
So patients who are bevacizumab eligible, and I usually consider that 75 or under, the elder patients, I generally don't use bevacizumab, but I've tended to use the combination of carboplatin pemetrexed with bevacizumab due mostly to toxicity profile. So it's much less toxic. The peripheral neuropathy is much less than using the carboplatin paclitaxel, but cytopenias are definitely more with any combination with bevacizumab.
And then what about maintenance?
As far as maintenance, if I use bevacizumab up front, I tend to continue it if there are no specific toxicities to the bevacizumab, just because we don't have the data of stopping it right now.
What about the combination of pemetrexed and bevacizumab in the patient, starting out with carbo, pem, and bevacizumab? Are there any situations where you utilize that?
So with the point break data, I think you can argue the point break data almost any direction and be correct and say, I'm using this regimen because of data. So with the point break data, again, carboplatin, pemetrexed, bevacizumab versus carboplatin, paclitaxel, bevacizumab, and then the maintenance were not different. And so based on that, you could argue to use either combination. And the fact that neither were different, I'm looking at side effect profile for patients. And again, that usually favors the pemetrexed containing arm. But if you think about cost, using pemetrexed and bevacizumab as a combination doesn't make a lot of sense. Most case scenarios, I'm looking at toxicity over cost. But I think as a society, we're going to have to be more careful, and we may be pushed to that as physicians to think about the cost of each regimen. But that being said, in my patients, I tend to use carboplatin, pemetrexed, and bevacizumab in these patients and continue pemetrexed and bevacizumab maintenance for patients who started on that regimen.
So just to kind of take this to the next level and also get into another topic that is extremely exciting, specifically checkpoint inhibitors, let's talk about your 72-year-old lady.
So she is a pretty typical patient with adenocarcinoma. So she had metastatic adenocarcinoma with multiple cervical lymph nodes, liver and bone metastases. And we tested for EGFR and ALK. They were negative. She did have an exon 12 mutation in KRAS. So for her, we chose first-line therapy with carboplatin and pemetrexed. She had borderline difficulty with her blood pressure, so we held off on bevacizumab for her. She had excellent response with four cycles and had a partial response. And after communication, and she had very few toxicities with her combination of carboplatin and pemetrexed, she was very pleased with the response and was feeling anxious to come off of therapy. So we made the decision to continue maintenance pemetrexed. And she continued to do well for another eight cycles before she started to develop progression.
What kinds of toxicity issues and side effects issues come up in patients who've been on pemetrexed for prolonged periods?
For the most part, it's cytopenias and fatigue. It's usually pretty well tolerated, but slowly but surely the cytopenias and fatigue start to affect them.
Have you seen any problems with the legs in terms of edema?
Yes. So even early on, not even just with maintenance pemetrexed, but patients can experience swelling and edema and weight gain, kind of general weight gain from pemetrexed-containing regimens, even without the steroid premedications, it can continue.
What happened with this lady?
So once she progressed, we, again, given the KRAS status, I tend not to use EGFR TKIs in patients with KRAS mutation. Generally, we think about clinical trials for these types of patients because KRAS tends to be more difficult to treat. And we had a trial, the phase 3 trial with anti-PD-1 antibody versus docetaxel, which she was interested in. And again, standard of care, we would have given her docetaxel anyway, and she was randomized to receive the anti-PD-1 antibody and continues on that therapy right now.
How long has she been on it?
Only about 3 months.
And what's going on in terms of her tumor?
She is just due for her initial scans right now.
Any side effect issues?
So she has had kind of typical side effects. So the anti-PD-1 antibodies are the checkpoint inhibitors that by blocking PD-1, you activate the immune system, and they've seen responses for lung cancer with these drugs. So with these drugs and activating the immune system, you see autoimmune type phenomenon. And so often the toxicities relate to that. And her main toxicity has been diarrhea, which is really a colitis type picture. It's been responsive to standard Imodium and Lamotil. We haven't had to start steroids. But for many of these toxicities, steroids is one of the common treatments.
Of course, diarrhea and colitis has been a tremendous concern in terms of ipilimumab. But kind of globally, just seeing the data presented, I wasn't really aware that it was that much of an issue with anti-PD-1 or anti-PD-L1.
I think ipilimumab is much more toxic than the anti-PD-1 or anti-PD-L1 antibodies, but it is a toxicity that we see. But again, in her, it's very manageable.
Right. So how much diarrhea would it have taken for you to give corticosteroids? Because that's always kind of an interesting thing to ask the melanoma people. I'm kind of curious from your perspective.
I would say persistent grade 2 or grade 3, and hers has been largely grade 1 and controlled with Imodium.
Anything you want to say about the data that's been reported with anti-PD-1 as well as anti-PD-L1?
I know that there's been extensive discussion on previous shows that you've had, and it's an exciting area for lung cancer. Lung cancer is not like melanoma, where it's generally an immunosuppressed tumor. And so to see response rates, even in the 15 to 20% range, which is better than what we get with docetaxel, is pretty impressive for these types of drugs alone. And in general, though they have different toxicities, if you watch patients closely and use steroids to treat, they're very treatable toxicities. And then activating the immune system and seeing some of these delayed responses, I think, is what's impressive in lung cancer. Because with lung cancer, even with targeted therapies, we do a good job at treating the tumor and blocking these activated tumors, but patients always become resistant and progress and succumb to their disease. So if we can find a way to harness the immune system and potentially with combinations, this is a very exciting area for lung cancer.
Any comments in terms of whether PD-L1 is going to be a good marker for benefit from these agents?
So I think what we've seen, and especially with the PD-L1 antibodies, is that it is a marker. There are some responses seen in PD-L1 negative patients, so it's not completely exclusionary, but it may show us a group of patients that have a better chance of responding. So you might bring responses from 15% to 30 to 40% with this marker.
I guess it looks like, though, that the people without the PD-L1 antibodies, some of them still benefit, though.
Exactly. So it's definitely not a one-to-one exclusion.
What was this lady's reaction to being put in this study? Typically, in this situation, the options off study are not that great. To me, if I were that patient, I'd be thrilled to get on that study.
Yeah, so this is a study that is interesting. You know, it moved from early phase into randomized phase 3 pretty quickly. Using the anti-PD-1 versus chemotherapy, it's nearly impossible to blind a physician or a patient because of things like alopecia and cytopenias that are very different in toxicity. So this is not a blinded study. And so when discussing with a patient the randomization, it's either they get docetaxel as they would have normally or a 50% chance to get a new agent that may have potential activity. So most patients are pretty excited and like the idea of activating their immune system toward the cancer.
So I was really curious when I saw that you had this case of this 50-year-old lady, because it ties into another ASCO. I thought this year's ASCO for lung was pretty good. There was some pretty cool stuff there. And one of the things that really interested me is the idea of BRAF inhibition, which I see this lady actually got. So maybe you can tell us a little bit about her.
Yeah, so this is kind of where we're going with lung cancer. So this is a 50-year-old woman who was a never smoker with metastatic adenocarcinoma, actually diagnosed in 2009. And so in 2009, we didn't necessarily have ALK readily testing and EGFR we were testing for. So over the course of time, EGFR was wild type, KRAS was wild type. She ultimately got tested for ALK and ROS1, which were both negative for gene rearrangement. But she started off on a clinical trial with a carboplatin, paclitaxel, and the talactoferin drug with a good response, did not receive maintenance therapy because of the way the clinical trial was. And after about 8 months, she developed progression, and we treated her with erlotinib. And again, we had minimal other choices for her, and she had very quick progression on erlotinib, as is typical for wild-type patients. Then she went on to receive pemetrexed, and this was pretty impressive in talking about responses to pemetrexed. So she got pemetrexed for 2 years.
Wow.
With excellent response. And I'll tell you, when she was progressing on erlotinib, it was close to saying, do you want hospice or we could try this chemo, you know? And because she was young and otherwise active, we wanted to go for more chemo, but hospice was a very close conversation. So this was a very big turnaround for her. And so she did very well for 2 years and then developed progression in the lung. She went on to receive docetaxel and had a partial response from docetaxel. But again, docetaxel is more difficult to continue past 4 to 6 cycles. So she had increasing toxicity. And so we were ready to kind of hold off on chemotherapy. But in today's day and age, we now have better molecular tests, you know? And so when somebody lives for 4 years with their lung cancer, it's time to go back and retest and reevaluate. So we had tissue from a biopsy of the tumor that had metastasized to her breast, which was after first-line chemotherapy. And we sent that for further molecular testing, things including HER2 and RET, and found a V600E BRAF mutation. So based on some case reports that there have been responses to vemurafenib and now dabrafenib, we initially started vemurafenib. This was before dabrafenib was approved. And she tolerated that, but developed some pretty significant dermatologic toxicity and photosensitivity that was pretty difficult to tolerate. We were having to dose reduce. So then we switched over to dabrafenib. She had an initial tumor response with vemurafenib and haven't had scans again since she started dabrafenib, but I think this will be equally as efficacious for her.
I'm curious about the dermatologic problem with the vemurafenib. I'm always asking the melanoma people or telling me that, you know, people just are so exquisitely sensitive to sunburn. What actually happened with her?
So this is pretty impressive. She's a very active person. She's really done remarkable with her metastatic lung cancer, and she plays golf. So we warned her about sun sensitivity. She covered every inch of her body with either clothes or suntan lotion. And there were two areas. She was wearing golf gloves and a long sleeve shirt, but there was a slice right around her wrist.
Wow.
That was open, both wrists. And then she had shorts on and was crossing her legs. So there was an area that must have sweated off the suntan lotion on her leg. Grade 3 burns on her legs and on her wrists. So very, very pronounced.
I know this can be seen with dabrafenib. How long has she been on it and any problems with it?
So she's only been on it for about 3 weeks now. So we just switched over. We have not seen problems with this so far.
Let's talk a little bit about your 48-year-old Vietnamese male. I mean, it's like a pretty long and complicated history. Maybe you can just sort of summarize this from a macro point of view, what happened with this man.
Right. Kind of the reason I added this to the list was to think about how to treat EGFR mutated patients, either with local treatments or systemic treatments based on their progression. And so this is a 48-year-old Vietnamese male who was initially diagnosed with stage 3B adenocarcinoma with bulky mediastinal lymph nodes and diagnosed in 2007. So was treated appropriately with concurrent chemotherapy and radiation. The choice there was weekly carboplatin paclitaxel. And he did well and 2 years later developed progression within the liver and lung. EGFR mutation testing was done, and he had a deletion in exon 19, but also an insertion in exon 18. And he initiated on erlotinib and had a 1 year response and then developed progression in the liver in 2010. So following the first progression, we basically started to think about, and this was systemic progression with decline in performance status. So rather than a local type of treatment, I would move to systemic treatment for this patient. And so we started on carboplatin and pemetrexed kind of as a first-line therapy for this patient. And so he got 6 cycles of carboplatin and pemetrexed with a partial response and then 4 cycles of maintenance pemetrexed and then developed progression within the liver. The lung was well controlled. He went on to receive docetaxel as second line and gemcitabine also as a third line cytotoxic therapy, each time with progression in the liver and not very much response. So his only area of disease was the liver. His lung had been cleared and he was off therapy, but declining. And so we actually had a conversation with our GI team and talked about targeted therapies to the liver, whether it be radiofrequency ablation, chemoembolization, or potential resection. And so after that conversation, because he had had response within the lung and potentially would be responsive to erlotinib again in the lung if he developed recurrence, and because the liver was the only area of disease, he went on to undergo a hepatotectomy in the left half of the liver. And in January 2011, he had the surgery and had no evidence of disease.
That part of the history really jumped off the page when I was looking at it. Mm-hmm. What do we know about removing hepatic mets and lung cancer, and how many times have you done it?
Infrequently, but this is just evidence of localized therapy for patients with localized recurrence in EGFR or those patients with targeted driver mutations. So with ALK, I would consider the same thing, and potentially with other targeted tumors that are responsive to targeted therapy. Because we know that even though up front the tumor has similar molecular abnormalities when first diagnosed, once they undergo treatment, we know there's significant heterogeneity between the primary tumor and potential metastatic sites. And so clearly this liver metastatic site was differentially responsive to the erlotinib.
That's interesting. Going back to the original testing on this patient, it was an exon 19 deletion and exon 18 insertion mutation. So I didn't realize you could have two different mutations. And what does it mean?
You know, the exon 19 definitely means sensitivity, and insertions in 18 can be sensitivity mutations, but it's less common. It may be a mutation that's there and not clinically significant for him. It's not completely clear.
But you can see multiple mutations in the same patient?
Rarely, but yes. And this was up front. This was not after erlotinib therapy. So
interesting. So what's his current situation?
So he went on and did develop progression, got another course of erlotinib with response, and then developed progression, got another course of pemetrexed and carboplatin with response. And he currently is now on a clinical trial with erlotinib and cabozantinib, and as a potential trying to reintroduce response into the tumor.
Erlotinib and cabozantinib, then the trial's in mutation patients?
It's in mutation-positive patients and for those who are resistant to erlotinib, so they have to be progressing on erlotinib and then receive the combination of erlotinib and cabozantinib together.
That's fascinating. Of course, oncologists are hearing a lot about cabozantinib and a variety of tumors. What do we know about it in lung cancer?
So in lung cancer, there is more limited data. Obviously, it's approved for thyroid cancer and has very good activity in prostate and renal cell. But in lung, it's been tested less. There are several ongoing trials, especially these combinations. So there's cabozantinib and erlotinib combinations in wild-type patients. And this is the trial for mutated patients. The phase one trial did see responses with the combination for patients who were resistant to erlotinib. And so this is what our phase two trial is based on.
Just to take a step back in the more basic in terms of use of erlotinib in patients with mutations, first of all, anything exciting going on in terms of new agents in patients progressing? Any thoughts about the second generation of irreversible EGFR TKIs, afatinib and dacomitinib? And now I'm starting to hear about a next generation of EGFR TKIs. What do we know about these agents?
So afatinib was just approved, you know, so they have very good activity with EGFR mutant lung cancer, and afatinib was tested versus platinum pemetrexed and platinum gemcitabine and showed improvement in progression-free survival in mutation-positive patients compared to chemotherapy. So it's clearly active in this group of patients. Afatinib has also been tested in the third line setting in refractory patients to EGFR TKIs. And though it showed an improvement in progression-free survival and a response rate in less than 10% of patients, there was no improvement in overall survival, but there may be some responses. And then with cetuximab, there have been responses in patients and potentially in the T790M resistance mutation. And so that's where I think there may be excitement for this combination in erlotinib-resistant patients.
As you mentioned, the drug's now available. How are you planning to utilize it in your non-protocol practice, if at all?
The pan-HER inhibitors tend to be a little more toxic to patients. And so I think I will probably start using it more in resistant patients following erlotinib or with a combination with cetuximab versus up front at first. And as I get experience with it and the toxicities, may move it up front from there. But we don't know the differential in efficacy between erlotinib and afatinib. There's some theoretical reasons why it might be more efficacious, but we don't have that data from clinical trials.
And, you know, I don't even know how easy or hard it might be to actually get reimbursement for afatinib, cetuximab. That's not the way it was approved. But Going beyond that, any thoughts about an oncologist using that combination? You kind of wonder about what kind of dermatologic toxicity. I mean, they did report dermatologic toxicity, but it does sound like a combination that might be a little bit rough.
So it's more tolerable than one would expect and not too significantly worse than having either agent alone. But there are multiple trials, a second line trial in ECOG that is going to be starting up and potentially a first line trial with the combination in SWOG. And so there may be opportunities to do these combinations on clinical trial rather than necessarily having to do it in practice.
So, you know, the common scenario that oncologists want to hear about is straightforward, patient's got a mutation, they get started on erlotinib, they have a good response, and then they start to slowly progress. Outside of a trial setting, how do you manage that?
So for slow progression, I mean, I've seen patients who have doubling of their disease as something that was sub-centimeter and it doubles over a year's time. And those patients, I tend to watch closely and continue erlotinib and not start something. Sometimes we'll do localized therapy, especially something in the bone, obviously in the brain. We tend to do local therapy for those. But even as in this case, as we discussed, sometimes even in somewhere like the liver or the lung, we might try localized therapy.
And if they are, you know, progressing more, so to speak, enough that you want to start using chemotherapy, do you keep the erlotinib going?
So I am of the camp that does not keep the erlotinib going in general, unless there's a reason, there's an area that starts progressing very quickly once they start chemotherapy. Most patients who have not seen chemotherapy, because now they're getting erlotinib first line, they respond very well to first line chemotherapy, and I don't think need erlotinib. And there's still that potential that you are letting a sensitive subpopulation grow out and potentially could use another EGFR TKI following chemotherapy. So I tend to not use it unless a patient is rapidly progressing and needs it.
So let's say you see that same patient, they're on erlotinib, they're definitely progressing, they're coming in for a second opinion from you, but the first opinion from the oncologist in practice is to try afatinib. Do you say, okay, that's fine, or I wouldn't do that?
So patients who receive erlotinib and have not had chemotherapy, as we know from the IPASS study and crossover from the first-line studies that have been done looking at chemo versus EGFR TKIs, patients have excellent responses to chemotherapy without a TKI. And so my second choice is to start a first-line chemotherapy on the patient and, again, potentially holding off on something like afatinib for after chemotherapy, because chemotherapy is very, very active and sometimes minimally toxic, because with things like erlotinib and afatinib, you have daily chronic toxicity versus the cyclical toxicity of chemotherapy.
But I mean, are responses seen or reported to afatinib after progression on erlotinib?
So that was the LuxLung-1 trial when they did it as second or third line, and it was versus placebo, but they had a less than 10%, but about 8% response rate.
Interesting. So let's finish out with your last patient, the 74-year-old man.
Yeah, so this was a 74-year-old African-American male, had metastatic squamous cell carcinoma, P63 positive, had multiple soft tissue nodules and metastatic disease within the lung. So we initially treated him. He was pretty symptomatic and had B symptoms with a significant weight loss and night sweats, and initiated chemotherapy with carboplatin and gemcitabine, and actually had a very significant response with the kind of melting away of the soft tissue nodules and improvement in his B symptoms. So he went on to receive 6 cycles of carboplatin and gemcitabine and then developed metastatic disease to the brain, so progression at that point, and stopped chemotherapy. And with the brain, he had 2 localized lesions and underwent SBRT to the localized lesions to the brain and did well for several months off therapy. And then upon progression, we initiated second-line docetaxel chemotherapy. And for squamous cell carcinoma, there are, as you know, limited options for second-line therapy. Really, we have docetaxel and we have erlotinib. This might be another case where Verostrat might help you if you wanted to use erlotinib in this type of case. And he developed progression after 2 cycles of docetaxel and then moved on, was having declining performance status. So we had a discussion regarding goals of care and quality of life, and he proceeded to move on to hospice therapy.
So, you know, unfortunately, we don't talk that much. There's not anywhere near the excitement there is in squamous cell. But what can we look for in the future? Now we're starting to see data coming out in terms of the types of mutations that occur with squamous cell. Do you think we're moving towards a targeted type approach for this disease in the future?
So I think the answer is definitely yes, but I think it's going to be slower, as we see, than with adenocarcinoma, because squamous cell carcinoma is largely a smoking-related cancer and is much more complex. And so the mutations and amplifications that we see are much more complex than in other diseases. But looking at things like FGFR, P10, DDR, and potentially targeting therapies to those, but I don't know that we're going to see the same types of responses as we do with the erlotinibs and the crizotinibs. So I think it's going to be combinations and looking into the complexity of this disease.
I'm curious what your thoughts are about nab-paclitaxel. It's been around and approved in breast cancer for a while and was approved in non-small cell not that long ago. I have heard people talk about, based on Mark Sosinski's trial, the possibility that it might be a little more effective in squamous cell. What do you think about NAB?
So the data with nab-paclitaxel, again, because squamous cell has so very few options, it's always helpful when you know that there may be a benefit in squamous cell carcinoma. So nab-paclitaxel was compared to carboplatin paclitaxel, and there were increased response rates in the squamous cell population. So potentially a benefit over carboplatin paclitaxel. And so I have used nab-paclitaxel in patients with squamous cell and seen responses. We don't know if it's any better than any of the other cytotoxics like gemcitabine, but definitely may be improved over paclitaxel.
Any thoughts in terms of tolerability and use in older patients?
So in general, when it's given on the weekly doses, it's generally more tolerable and less neurotoxic than the paclitaxel. And the neurotoxicity with paclitaxel can be pretty profound for patients. So that's, again, a potential use for patients also.